unmistakably with the protesters in the streets, the vast majority of them young people, and the future of their country. The Green Movement was violently suppressed. Ayatollah Khamenei endorsed the bogus election results. Security forces and Ahmadinejad thugs cracked down brutally. Scores were killed, hundreds injured, and thousands arrested, including many prominent reformers. On June 20th, a sniper shot and killed Neda Aga Sultan, a 26-year-old musician, as she stood on the edge of a peaceful protest. A cell phone video captured her bleeding to death on the pavement. It went instantly viral, appalling many Americans and, in some quarters, shaming their conscience. It shamed mine. I want America to always identify with Neda and those like her, whom the world hasn't made cynical yet, who struggle against danger and daunting odds to claim the rights we fought a revolution to secure. I want to be in the streets with them, if only figuratively, raising our voices in support and using our influence to encourage other governments to do the same. I want State Department and National Security Council officials to devise ways we can help them succeed, not just figure out how to take a stand without risking anything. They must be our priority, not our only priority, but a greater priority than placating the regime that persecutes them. In fairness, as the violence against the mostly peaceful protests mounted that summer, Obama's calls for restraint by the regime became somewhat more forceful. But it was late in coming, and never as forceful as it should have been from a president with his eloquence. Secret talks that led to negotiations for a nuclear deal were underway, and I'm sure he worried they would be jeopardized by greater pressure from us on behalf of the protesters. I worried that Iranians will remember our minimal engagement in their struggle, our tepid support, and when their day of liberation comes, our negligence will not be forgotten. I had many disagreements with President Obama's policies that I argued publicly and sometimes vociferously. As I described in earlier chapters, I supported his decision to use NATO air power in Libya, but was appalled when he quickly disengaged before Libya stabilized, rationalizing his irresolution as leading from behind. I was angered by his refusal to provide Ukraine with the weapons it needs to defend itself from Russia's organized attacks on its sovereignty. And I thought his failure to make good on his threat of military action to punish the Assad regime's use of chemical weapons was a shockingly bad mistake, the biggest of his presidency, a strategic blunder that injured the security of our interests and the progress of our values throughout the Middle East and elsewhere. I never doubted the sincerity of President Obama's conviction that the ultimate goal of his administration's foreign policy was a safer, freer, and more just world. But he refused to make the hard calls that goal entails. I don't know if his irresolution stemmed from indecisiveness or a reluctance to do anything that risked failure. But whatever it was, it confounded allies, encouraged enemies, and left a lot of brave people struggling to live in freedom without meaningful support from the leader of the free world. That said, it's fair to also observe that for all our disagreements, I never doubted President Obama shared the 75-year bipartisan consensus that American leadership of the free world was a moral obligation and a practical necessity. I think he tried to defer some of the responsibilities of that leadership, which weakened it, but I never believed he thought we should abandon it. I'm not sure what to make of President Trump's convictions. At times, as a candidate and as president, he has appeared to be more than merely a realpolitik adherent. He seemed to mock the idea that America has any business at all promoting its values abroad. I don't know if that is sincerely his view or if he believes that the global progress of democracy and the rule of law should be only a distant notional goal of American statecraft. He threatened to deliberately kill the spouses and children of terrorists, implying that an atrocity of that magnitude would show the world America's toughness. His lack of empathy for refugees, innocent, persecuted, desperate men, women, and children is disturbing. The way he speaks about them is appalling, as if welfare or terrorism were the only purposes they could have in coming to our country. His reaction to unflattering news stories, calling them fake news, whether they're credible or not, is copied by autocrats who want to discredit and control a free press. He has declined to distinguish the actions of our government from the crimes of despotic ones. He seems uninterested in the moral character of world leaders and their regimes. The appearance of toughness, or a reality show facsimile of toughness, seems to matter more than any of our values. Flattery secures his friendship, criticism his enmity. He has showered with praise some of the world's worst tyrants. He said Putin was doing a great job rebuilding Russia, failing to note that the rebuilding has come at the expense of liberty and justice in Russia, and in many instances, at the cost of Russian lives. He has seemed just as smitten with Xi Jinping, despite the campaign of repression Xi waged as he consolidated his vast power. He hardly ever talks about human rights as an object of his policies. He went on a 2-week, 5-country trip to Asia and never raised the subject, not in Vietnam, where political dissidence is a crime, not in the Philippines, where the blustering Rodrigo Duterte holds murderous notions about criminal justice. President Trump's noticeably keen regard for Duterte feels more like an expression of genuine admiration than a realist's recognition that the Philippines are a valuable partner in the region. I'm a longtime advocate for better relations between the U.S. and Vietnam. I believe we share common interests, and I have visited the country many times, most recently last summer. I've never once gone to Hanoi and not raised human rights issues with my hosts. They would be surprised if I didn't, or if any American on an official visit didn't appeal for greater freedom and justice in that country. That's what visiting American officials do. The world expects us to be concerned with the condition of humanity. We should be proud of that reputation. I'm not sure the president understands that. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson compounded that perception when he warned State Department employees not to condition relations with nations too heavily on their adoption of values we've come to after a long history of our own. That attitude feeds the notion that at best this administration believes human rights protests ought to be reserved for America's adversaries and not our friends or countries where we have other interests. Such an approach substantiates our adversaries' complaint that our support for human rights is cynical, that we use it only as a weapon against our enemies. We meddle in their domestic affairs and turn a blind eye to bad actors whose favor we need. That discredits our moral authority wherever we invoke it. There have been glimmers of hope that the president recognizes our values have a place in the conduct of foreign policy, or that his senior national security team has managed to prevent the idea from being banished altogether by the weirder members of this administration. I'm thankful that some of the latter were eventually shown the door. Self-proclaimed nationalist radicals Steve Bannon and Sebastian Gorka among them. Bigger misfits haven't been seen inside a White House since William Taft got stuck in his bathtub. Last December, the administration sanctioned 5 more Russians under the Magnitsky Act, and the president signed an executive order citing serious human rights abuse and corruption around the world that imposed on 13 named individuals sanctions authorized by the provisions of the Global Magnitsky Act, which Ben Cardin and I also authored. The list of targeted people could have been longer, and some deserving individuals were spared. But the executive order actually expanded the reach of our bill and represents real progress toward the norm of American diplomacy, and I heartily welcome it. The administration's recently released National Security Strategy document simultaneously offered hope and disappointment to human rights advocates. In one passage, it averts, "We are not going to impose our values on others." In another, it promises, "We will continue to champion American values and offer encouragement to those struggling for human dignity in their societies." As we speak, Iranians have taken to the streets again, and not just in Tehran, where the affluent and well-educated want to live in a more modern society. The protests began outside the capital and have spread to many cities, including the religious city of Qom. In 2009, the protests were focused on disputed election results. These protests are broader and, from the point of view of the regime, more subversive. Their criticism includes Iran's military adventurism in the region and the power of the mullahs. Some protesters are reported to have shouted, "Death to Hezbollah, Iran's proxy in the Arab world." Others have demanded that Iran no longer continue as an Islamic republic. Another crackdown is sure to follow. As in 2009, the worst of it won't be public, but away from the cameras. To his credit, President Trump quickly identified with the protesters and warned the regime that the world is watching. He has followed up with other statements. Will he persist? I don't know. He has been more outspoken thus far than our European allies, and that's something administration diplomacy should address. We're the leader of the free world, and we should work to rally our allies to the side of justice in Iran. Acting in unison with other nations, we'll refute the regime's criticism that the great Satan is behind the protests. The administration should negotiate an agreement on multilateral economic and diplomatic sanctions against the regime if the protests are violently suppressed and protesters killed or imprisoned. They should put on notice foreign companies that do business in Iran and the U.S. that they will be targeted if they are in any way, even indirectly, supplying materials or services to the security apparatus of the regime. I also don't know if the president's engagement much earlier and outspoken than his predecessors is mostly due to the fact that Iran is an adversary. I hope it's because he sees the connection there between America's interests and values, and that by promoting the latter, he defends the former. Encouragingly, he unexpectedly criticized Saudi Arabia's blockade of Yemen around the same time, taking issue with an ally he was not previously willing to rebuke. I hope both actions indicate an evolution in his administration's view toward the understanding that our values are more than talking points with which to shame our enemies. It's hard to know what to expect from President Trump, what's a pose, what's genuine. As in other areas, the character of the president will likely be reflected in the content and conduct of foreign policy. But the extent to which that is the case will depend on the restraining effect of his more experienced advisors, counsel, and, I genuinely hope, his growing recognition that leader of the free world is more than an honorific. It is a moral obligation more important than the person who possesses it. There have been times in the past, and there will be times in the future, when America's conduct at home and in the world will fall short of our own high standards. That doesn't mean that our values are imperfect, only that we are. In those instances, our true friends will encourage us to change course. But we should never believe that our fallibility disqualifies us from supporting the rights of others. That isn't humility. It's an abdication of moral responsibility. What matters most is that we remain confident in our principles, mindful that they are not ours alone, and that we recognize that to be on the right side of history is to support people denied their basic rights. Of course, we should recognize that some nations are more skeptical of American influence, and when dissidents there ask for our silence, we should respect their wishes. But when courageous people call on us by name, when they plea for our solidarity and peaceful demonstrations against their government, when they write their protest banners in English, that is a good indication that we can and should do more to support their cause. When people peacefully appeal for their rights, we should encourage them. When they are thrown in prison, we should work for their release. When they face intimidation and violence, we should condemn it. This applies not only to our enemies, but to our friends, whether they are long-standing partners like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, or emerging partners like Vietnam. They won't enjoy these conversations. But if we really value these relationships, we will make the case to them that the only guarantee of their nation's long-term stability is the inclusion of all its peoples in the rights and protections their leaders possess and in the promise of a better future. We will only get so far by urging abusive regimes, whether in private or public, to treat their people better. We also need to support those people directly wherever and however we can to help them promote their aspirations and prepare for the day that they will govern themselves. What this help entails varies from country to country, but its aim is to strengthen civil society to balance the power of the state. It often includes providing access to factual information by broadcasting it ourselves, or helping closed societies get it on their own. It can include support for political parties, the middle class, labor unions, student organizations, religious groups, and other associations. It can be strengthening the institutions of a free society, an independent media, legislatures, courts of justice, uncorrupt bureaucracies, election commissions, and monitors. What form these institutions take is not up to us. America's institutions of governance are the result of 230 years of experimentation, trial and error, and our own unique experience. Other societies will develop in their own ways, consistent with their own cultures and traditions. Critics, whether they call themselves realists or non-interventionalists or just indifferent, maintain that active support for the political development of closed societies constitutes more than a strategy for changing the behavior of abusive regimes. It's a ploy to change the regimes themselves. Correct. And why shouldn't it be? I'm not suggesting armed revolution, but regime change achieved by giving people the tools and skills they need to work peacefully for it and build a better society. Why wouldn't we want autocracies replaced by democracies everywhere in the world? Our goal isn't to coexist eternally with regimes that are hostile to our most basic principles of justice. We deal with states like that because we have to, not because we wish them well. And while we deal with them, we shouldn't forget that our ultimate goal is to see the victims of oppression supplant their oppressors. It is one thing to recognize obstacles to change and to understand the world as it is with all its corruption and cruelty. But it is a moral failure to believe tyranny and injustice are the inevitable tragedies of man's fallen nature, that there are some places in the world that will not change or aren't worth the effort to make better. They can be changed. They have been. And not only by force of arms, as with Germany or Japan, but peacefully, with international pressure and support. Every independent democratic country in the world once had a government less just and accountable, whether it was monarchical, dictatorial, or imperial. Progress toward a freer, more just world is the history of the world. Change doesn't always proceed as quickly as we want it to, but it comes. We were once the world's only democratic republic, and now we're one of more than 100. The ranks of free nations have swelled thanks in large part to the example, leadership, and support of the United States. And thanks to all those people and organizations in every corner of the world, the philosophers, the politicians, the activists, and the ordinary decent men and women who throughout history have not let injustice stand without trying to right it. Thanks to idealistic realists in the National Endowment for Democracy, the International Republican Institute, the National Democratic Institute, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Human Rights First, Freedom House, the International Rescue Committee, the McCain Institute, and countless other advocates. I have disagreed with their positions from time to time, but I'm proud to have worked with them for causes that are just and achievable. And thank you to those in the latest generation and in future generations who will be involved in mankind and make another better world. I'm grateful to have played a part in that progress. The gratification I've gotten from defending the rights of subjugated peoples has outlasted the satisfaction gained from personal successes, and it has outlasted the sting of life's disappointments. The image I have of the Maidan in Kiev, of the massive crowd giving me their attention as I struggled to say a few words of encouragement, far surpasses in effect all the recognition given me because I managed to stay in the public spotlight as long as I have. I am grateful to the freedom fighters, the justice seekers, the change agents, and civil society builders the world over for the example they set for me, for their reminder that we are not inevitably the victims of our fallen nature. We are all sinners, far from perfection, but we can compensate a little for our flaws and the injuries we've caused when we fight for the dignity of our fellow man. We know our lives were not entirely squandered on ourselves. When you reach my age and condition, that knowledge is a great relief, a little hope for God's mercy. Even the smallest gestures in support of the hardest causes, the ones that seem futile, mean something to those struggling in them, and they are the ones that end up meaning the most to you. They're so appreciative of your support, no matter how modest it is. But it's not their gratitude that moves you the most. It's their faith. They refuse to accept defeat, to face facts. They refuse to lose hope no matter how long they're jailed, no matter how many of their friends are killed. They don't despair. They persist. It's an honor to stand with them, although most of the time all I can offer is my voice raised on their behalf or an open door to my office, an appeal to the administration, an introduction to other members of Congress. I have done what little I can to stand in solidarity with forces of change in countries aligned with us and opposed to us, in Russia, in Ukraine, in Georgia, and Moldova, in China, in Serbia, Kosovo, Montenegro, in Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, in Iran, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, in Cuba, Nicaragua, in Zimbabwe, in South Africa, and wherever else people fighting for their human rights wanted our help. I've protested killings, torture, and imprisonments. I worked to sanction oppressive regimes. I've encouraged international pressure on the worst offenders. I've helped secure support for people building the framework of an open society. I've monitored elections, consoled the families of political prisoners, worried about the risk-takers, and mourned their deaths. I've gotten more from them than they've gotten from me. I've gotten their hope, their faith, and their friendship. For the last 20 years, I've tried to help the opposition in Belarus overcome the ruthless regime of Alexander Lukashenko that has misruled that country since 1994. I've met with Belarusians from all backgrounds who are fighting to change their country, students, professors, lawyers, former government officials, retired military, business people, technocrats, and actors. Joe Lieberman and I applied for visas to go to Belarus in 2004. The government refused to grant them, and we have been unwelcome there since. Opposition representatives have had to leave the country to meet with members of Congress enlisted in their cause. We have met in Vilnius, Lithuania, and in Riga, Latvia. We've met in Brussels and Washington. In solidarity with them, I denounced Lukashenko's fraudulent election in 2001, only to watch him steal another one in 2005, and another in 2010, and another in 2015. I called for the release from prison of Lukashenko's opponent in the 2001 election, Mikhail Marinich, only to see him remain behind bars for another 5 years after suffering a stroke. I've called for the release of other political prisoners with no greater success. I've watched Lukashenko work as closely with Putin's Russia as if Belarus were still a vassal state, then try to lead Belarus toward greater independence, and then always fall back into subservience to the Kremlin. I've made countless statements, attended numerous conferences, helped pass legislation imposing sanctions on their regime, called on other nations to impose sanctions, and when they did, called for more. I made all manner of pleas and threats and promises, all focused on supporting the rights of the Belarus people to govern themselves. And to what effect? Doesn't appear to have had any. Lukashenko is still there. He's still jailing his opponents, and worse, he's still obedient to Putin. In February and March 2017, tens of thousands of people took to the streets of Minsk and a dozen other cities. The regime responded with mass arrests. International calls for the release of protesters were ignored. In 2015, The Guardian published an analysis of the prospects for change in Belarus in the wake of the successful Maidan protests in Ukraine. It found Lukashenko's power secure and the opposition to be powerless, and declared a revolution is impossible in Belarus. But as Winston Churchill observed, success consists of going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. Every time I meet with members of the Belarus opposition, they're as determined and sure of themselves and as grateful for international support as were the first dissidents I met all those years ago. Often they are the same people I met with years ago. They believe, they fight, and they persist. They are a rebuke to the cynics, a tonic for the weary fatalism that can overcome even the happiest warrior. Like them, I believe with all my heart that one day they or their children will prevail. And it won't be because they reached the end of history in Belarus and it bent inevitably toward justice. It will happen as it's happened elsewhere, because brave men and women inside the country and loyal friends outside made painstaking and enduring efforts to make it happen. In history, Nobel laureate and freedom fighter Liu Xiaobo said nothing is fated. Liu Xiaobo died in the summer of 2017 from multiple organ failure caused by liver cancer while under armed guard in a provincial capital in northeast China. His pleas and the appeals of his wife and his many supporters that he be allowed to receive treatment in the West were ignored, as were all previous appeals for his release from prison. He was a scholar and poet and one of the world's most eloquent proponents of Gandhian nonviolence and resistance to tyranny. He had been teaching at Columbia University when the student protests in Tiananmen Square began in 1989. He rushed home and joined them. He began a hunger strike on June 2nd. When the army moved in on the night of June 3rd to massacre protesters and take the square, Liu urged the students to remain nonviolent, even wresting a rifle from the hands of one activist, and negotiated with the army to allow several thousand to leave the square peacefully. He was arrested 2 days later, fired from his university position, and his books banned. He was incarcerated for most of the next 2 years and released after his conviction for counter-revolutionary incitement. Forbidden to write, he published his next book in Taiwan. He traveled back to the U.S. in 1993 and rejected advice from friends that he seek asylum here. He was arrested in 1995 and held under house arrest for 9 months for starting a petition calling for political reform. He was arrested again in October 1996 for calling for Taiwan's peaceful reunification with China and sentenced to 3 years in a re-education camp. For the next 9 years, he was constantly surveilled by the police and harassed. His phone and internet connection were cut after he wrote an essay in 2004 criticizing the regime. Charter 08, which Liu helped write, was released on December 10, 2008. A political manifesto modeled on Charter 77, written by Václav Havel and other Czech dissidents, Charter 08 demanded democratic elections, an end to one-party rule, and the privatization of state-controlled industries. Liu was arrested 2 days before the charter's release. The 300 original signers of the document were interrogated to gather evidence against him. He was held in solitary confinement and denied access to a lawyer until he was formally charged with inciting subversion in June 2009. He was tried and convicted the following December and sentenced to 11 years in prison. His wife wasn't allowed to attend his trial. American embassy officials and officials from other Western embassies in Beijing requested permission to observe his trial and were denied. They stood outside the courthouse in solidarity. The court denied Liu's request to read testimony he had prepared for his trial. Another appeal on behalf of human dignity that began, "I have no enemies." The United States and the governments of many other nations condemned his conviction and petitioned Beijing for his release. The next year, the Nobel Committee awarded Liu the 2010 Peace Prize. When he learned of the honor, he dedicated it to the Tiananmen martyrs. He was, of course, forbidden to receive it in person. His wife, Liu Xia, was placed under house arrest and not allowed to travel to Oslo either. An empty chair represented him at the ceremony, where the statement he had written for his trial was read. He was among the most prominent political prisoners in the world. Hundreds of influential and powerful people spoke up for him and appealed for his release. Presidents, prime ministers, monarchs, statesmen, celebrated writers and artists, representatives from the legislatures of many countries, including me. When I learned he had died, I said he would want it remembered that his imprisonment and lonely death were only the latest example of China's assaults on human rights, democracy, and freedom. He had been relentless, I remembered, in pursuit of a democratic China. What had his relentlessness achieved? What had all the international attention focused on him done, all the public pressure applied to Beijing to win his release from prison, and when he was dying to get him out of the country? It hadn't succeeded. Nothing he did in his life can be said to have substantially moved China a step closer to the freedom he bravely and persistently urged for his compatriots. Nothing the world did can be said to have spared his suffering. Did any of it change anything? When Liu died, President Trump was in Paris offering what great respect he has for Xi Jinping, a great leader who loves China, who wants to do what is right for China. Maybe all we can say of his relentless struggle is that it was the right thing to do. He lived a righteous life, and a righteous life is its own reward. But I think we can say more. His struggle will inspire others to carry it forward. His suffering was for a purpose greater than himself, and that purpose won't be abandoned. Others will suffer for it. Others will die for it. But it will succeed in time. It might be many years, many decades, before the human rights of the Chinese people are secure in their own country. But it will happen. It will happen because the rationalization that Asia isn't the West and Confucianism isn't compatible with individual liberty is a lie. It is natural for human beings to want to live without fear of oppression. It is natural to want to make choices for yourself, all your choices. It's natural to the human mind to use our needs, wishes, desires, the ideas that interest us to direct our lives, to inform our choices about where to live, what to do for work, whom to love, how many children to have. If the state can control some of those decisions, they can control all decisions, even who lives and dies. It's unnatural to the human heart, every human heart, to surrender its agency. Every generation of Chinese produces people who refuse to accept the state's authority over their conscience. They will read Liu Xiaobo, admire his courage, honor his sacrifice, learn from him, and press forward until some Chinese generation succeeds. Those in the West who rallied to his defense were reminded by the regime's recalcitrance, by its refusal to be moved by expressions of outrage or appeals to human decency, that China is more than just a massive market and investment opportunity, more than the world's most populous nation of consumers, more than an economic, military, and political rival. China represents the alternative to Western civilization, an unjust and cruel alternative. But for all the vibrancy of its economy, all its commercial sophistication and enterprising people, China's rulers lack the vision to see around the corner of history because they lack faith in the human heart and trust only power and fear to achieve their ends. We must persist, too. We have more than commercial interests at stake in our relationship with China, and even those are ultimately poorly served by letting China abuse its citizens without protest or sanction. We must appeal and insist and condition relations on China's progress toward a freer, more just society. The freer they are, the less of a threat they become. Above all else, we must stand in solidarity with the imprisoned, the silenced, the tortured, and the murdered, because we are a country with a conscience. It is a mistake to view foreign policy, as the Chinese would like us to view it, as simply transactional. It's a mistake and a dangerous idea. Depriving the oppressed of a beacon of hope could lose us the world we have built and thrived in. It could cost our reputation in history as the nation distinct from all others in our achievements, our identity, and our enduring influence on mankind. Our values are central to all three. Were they not, we would be one great power among the others of history. We would have acquired wealth and power for a time before receding into the disputed past. But we are a more exceptional country than that. We saw the world as it was, and we made it better. Chapter 10, Regular Order. Something was off. I didn't know exactly what. Fatigue, mainly. I felt unusually tired. Of course, I'm in my 80s, and men my age are supposed to be tired. But my motor has always run at more RPMs than the average geezer. I'm restless and curious and usually looking forward to something so that I don't tire easily. When I'm a little beat, it's nothing I can't fix by taking a weekend off. I thank my 106-year-old mother. Her main attributes are enthusiasm, wanderlust, and good genes. Her vivaciousness is a force of nature. Even now, after a stroke has slowed her down, when her brisk pace is a memory and speaking can be a chore, and her twin sister's passing robbed her of her life's longest companion, there's still a spark in her, a brightness in her eyes that would light up the world if she could resume her peripatetic life. I've inherited modest measures of her qualities, sufficient to give me the energy for a busy life and the enthusiasm for it. I'm the son and grandson of admirals. That's the first line of my biography. But I am my mother's son. I always have been. Thank you, Mother. Thank you. I attributed my weariness to the trip I had recently returned from, a 5-day run to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and a brief stop in the UAE. I have made so many quick trips to the region, like this one, without jet lag bothering me very much. I didn't know why this one had made me so tired. It had been an interesting time. The highlight, as it is every year, was the promotion and re-enlistment ceremony in Kabul on the 4th of July, presided over by our delegation and the commanding officer of our forces in Afghanistan, General John Nicholson. I've spent the 4th in Afghanistan or Iraq every year since 2003, and every visit I get choked up at a re-enlistment ceremony. Hundreds of warriors, some having served multiple combat tours, celebrate our country's independence by voluntarily surrendering theirs and signing up for more hazard and stress. I look forward to the inspiration every year. I also enjoyed the company. Whenever possible, I like to travel with a politically diverse delegation, ideally with a few new members of the Senate along, and I invite people with that idea in mind. This delegation included my old friend and road trip buddy, Lindsey Graham. He's the second funniest man I've met in this business, after Mo Udall, my Arizona congressional colleague and mentor. With an eye for the absurd, he can brighten up the dreariest day and make any journey, even the most exhausting slog, fun. He has a hard time not being amusing and amused. We had traveled to Kyrgyzstan in 2005, crossing paths in Bishkek, the capital, with a visiting delegation from the House of Representatives. Our ambassador to Kyrgyzstan had asked if we would mind combining delegations for a scheduled meeting with the new prime minister. Lindsey and I had both served in the House before we were elected to the Senate, and we both have friends there. But Senate snobbery being as pervasive as it is, ask any House member, we do have a not very Republican attitude in the Senate that tends to look down at the so-called People's Chamber. We serve 6-year terms, and the rules of the Senate allow each member considerable independence. Every man and woman a king, we like to think. Not so much in the House. Nevertheless, not wishing to impose on the Prime Minister's time any more than necessary, we consented to the request. The House delegation was late. We started the meeting without them. The Prime Minister was an urbane fellow, and we were in the middle of a pleasant, interesting conversation when an agent elevator noisily stopped on the floor where we were meeting and disgorged its passengers, the tardy members of the House delegation. Introductions were made and the previous discussion was suspended until our new cohort each had a few minutes to make brief introductory remarks. One of them, a nice guy from Tennessee, attempted to use his state's topography to establish a bond with our host. Like an Army scout trying to communicate with an Indian chief in a 1950s Western, he spoke slowly and loudly, using his hands to illustrate his message. "I come from a state with big mountains," he offered. "Kyrgyzstan has bigger mountains," he acknowledged, shaping the outline of a mountain peak with his hands. "Kyrgyzstan, very beautiful. My state, very beautiful." To which the Prime Minister responded nonchalantly and in very good English, "Yes, I know. I have a daughter at Vanderbilt." I almost didn't dare to look at Lindsey. When I did shoot him a glance, he was shaking from the pressure of not bursting out laughing. His eyes were leaking, and he was emitting little sounds that I guess were strangled cackles. Then I had to fight, with mixed results, to keep a straight face. We've had a regular laugh over that memory and scores of others from our travels ever since. He is the best company. Sheldon Whitehouse, another frequent traveling companion and a smart, widely respected senator, had joined us on that July 4th trip, too. And I had invited two other colleagues, both in their first terms, Dave Perdue of Georgia and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. As I noted earlier, I always welcome a chance to introduce new senators to our national security challenges in person, so to speak. And I especially value those opportunities when the members hold opposing views. Dave and Elizabeth certainly fit that bill. Dave's very conservative, and Elizabeth is very liberal, and there are very few issues where they would naturally find common ground. That's one of the values of these trips. When you're traveling long distances in short amounts of time, much of it in the confined space of a military airplane, and keeping a crowded schedule on the ground, you put a premium on collegiality, courtesy, and good humor, not partisan affiliation. At dinner, and I always try to schedule at least one private, non-official dinner in a restaurant in each country visited, you enjoy a good joke or a story and conversations that aren't strictly about politics and issues. You get to know people as more than the person across the Senate floor who disagrees with you or votes against your bill. Your staffs get to know each other, too. You become friendly, and sometimes you become friends. And while you will go on debating and voting against each other, you're less likely to resent it, and maybe every once in a while you'll find a way to work together on something beneficial to the country. That's the idea, anyway. Doesn't always work out that way, but it does often enough that it's worth continuing the effort. I'm not friends with all my Senate colleagues, and some, no doubt, will eagerly make the same disclaimer about me. But for all the times I haven't improved the comity of the Senate, the angry outburst, the heated exchange, the cutting sarcasm I'm guilty of from time to time, I also have a reputation for cross-party friendships and bipartisan collaboration. I led delegations overseas that have helped colleagues become better friends and better senators. If you ask me for a short list of accomplishments in my Senate career I'm proudest of, that would be one. Usually, I return from an interesting trip excited about the experience and my mind occupied with things I had learned and want to follow up on. This time, I felt run down, something else that I couldn't put my finger on. I didn't think it was serious, necessarily, just an unfamiliar sense that I wasn't myself. It worried me, since it was the second time in a little more than a month that I had felt run down and off kilter. I had taken a more arduous trip in May with friends John Barrasso from Wyoming and Chris Coons of Delaware to Australia, Vietnam, and Singapore, 7 days, each heavily scheduled with meetings and public events. I was bone-tired when I got back from that one, too, just a few days before former FBI Director James Comey was scheduled to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee. I'm an ex-officio member of the committee, which means I'm usually the last to ask the witness questions. When my turn finally came, I tried asking Mr. Comey a question that Lindsay had texted my staff. Something happened between reading the question and asking it. To this day, I'm really not sure what caused it. But as was widely noted at the time, I was incomprehensible. It was a high-profile hearing, carried live by the cable news networks. My strange performance was the focus of commentary on cable and fuel for Twitter. I felt embarrassed for myself and sorry for confusing Comey. It was one of the more mortifying experiences of my public career. Even now, I wince at the memory of it. I tried to move on and put the whole thing down to a bad bout of jet lag. But a small concern nagged at me, and then I couldn't shake the fatigue from the July trip. As luck had it, my regular physical at the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale was scheduled for that Friday, July 14th. I mentioned my general fatigue to my doctors as well as recent instances when I'd felt a little foggy mentally and brief episodes of double vision. They added a brain scan to my exam. I left Mayo that afternoon and was happily driving north on I-17 to Hidden Valley for the weekend when my phone rang. It was my primary physician. She informed me that the scan had found something. She didn't say what. Okay, I can be back there Monday morning, I agreed. No, she replied emphatically, you need to turn around and come back now. A few hours later, I was being prepped for surgery. A top neurosurgeon at Mayo, who I heard later had been called at the airport as he was about to depart on a long-planned trip, was enlisted to perform the operation, a minimally invasive craniotomy with eyebrow incision. In other words, they cut a hole in my skull along my left eyebrow to look at my brain's left frontal lobe and see what the trouble was. There they found a 2-inch blood clot, and skillfully and thoroughly, according to every doctor who subsequently reviewed the surgeon's handiwork, removed it and sent a tissue sample to the pathology lab. The operation took 5.5 hours. When I came out of the anesthesia, one of my doctors asked if I knew the year. I answered correctly, which was, he informed me, the first time a patient of his could remember the year immediately following brain surgery. Brain scans after the surgery reaffirmed the clot had been entirely removed. I showed no signs of cognitive difficulty. I cracked a couple of jokes to reassure myself as much as my doctors that I still had my wits. I was released the next day at my insistence and went home feeling a little vain about how quickly I had gotten back on my feet, how tough I still was. I felt gratified when one of my doctors told me I showed an unusually high tolerance for pain, and I made sure to repeat the observation to friends. That might strike listeners as a rather petty concern under the circumstances. But under the circumstances, there's comfort to be found in one's lifelong idiosyncrasies. I was back at the Mayo the following Tuesday to meet with a medical team that included neuro-oncologists and to discuss the pathology report. It had revealed that the blood clot had been a primary brain tumor called a glioblastoma. I'd never heard the term before and didn't immediately grasp the meaning of the diagnosis. I knew it was serious from the sober demeanor of the medical professionals in the room, and when someone, I don't remember who, mentioned it was the same cancer that Ted had, I got the picture. The Mayo team was confident the surgeon had gotten out all the tumor that was visible. But this kind of brain cancer has tentacles, they explained, that can lurk invisibly. It almost always comes back. I was otherwise in very good physical condition, they informed me, and recovering from the craniotomy with astonishing speed. Good to know. We discussed odds and averages and courses of treatment, the standard approach being chemotherapy and radiation. How soon can I start? I asked. Dates were suggested, and I said I'd rather start after I returned from Washington. I got some puzzled looks at that. I want to go back to Washington, I explained. We're in the middle of a big health care debate, and there will be votes I can't miss. How soon can I go back? Not soon, was the consensus, to which I replied, sooner. They didn't want me 30,000 feet in the air and subjected to cabin pressure while I had a hole in my head and maybe some swelling from the recent operation. They eventually relented and agreed I could leave a week from then following a quick exam to make sure I was fit to travel. We discussed what to do if there was a problem during the flight and what symptoms to watch for that might signal a stroke. We chartered a private plane and made plans to fly to Washington on Tuesday, July 25th. I had a lot to think about, obviously. A thing like that takes a little getting used to for me and my family. My first reaction was to assign the news to the place in me where I store memories of adverse experiences and not accord it greater significance than any other. Here's another one, I thought. Just another one. In the blur of those first hours and days after the diagnosis, I knew I would have to concentrate on a purpose unrelated to my cancer, or I would have been balled up with shock and anxiety. The news of my diagnosis was followed by an outpouring of sympathy and support. I heard from scores of people, presidents, colleagues, foreign leaders, people in business, sports, and entertainment. President Obama tweeted, "Cancer doesn't know what it's up against. Give it hell, John." I liked that quite a bit, especially since it came from someone to whom I had given a little hell to from time to time. I heard from both Presidents Bush, too, and both Clintons, and from President Trump and the First Lady. I'm grateful to all of them. I had a long talk with an old friend, Joe Biden, whom I first got to know when I was the Navy's liaison to the Senate, and he was a first-term senator, way back in the Jurassic era. His son, Beau, had succumbed to the same kind of brain cancer. Our conversation was equal parts practical and encouraging, an old friend helping another through a rough patch he had prior experience with. Joe and I have argued a lot over the years, but he is a first-class human being, and it's a lucky thing to be his friend. Many well-wishers were friends and acquaintances, but most people who sent kind regards to me I had never met. They meant the most to me. Public figures sometimes complain about the abuse heaped on them by people who don't really know them. I've had my share, some of it deserved, no doubt, but it's nothing compared to the unearned kindnesses I received from strangers as I've walked through airports and ballparks and other public spaces. This won't last, I always told myself, and I tried to repay their generosity with a few moments of my time, asking their names, posing for pictures, making jokes. Now I was inundated with concern and prayers from kind-hearted strangers. I felt unusually blessed. But as much as I appreciated it, the public attention to my condition was concentrating my attention on it as well. There's nothing to be gained by that, I told myself. What will be, will be. So I focused on work. I wanted to go to work. I wanted to go back to the Senate. Before the diagnosis, I had discussed with Mark Salter an idea for a speech I was thinking about giving that I wanted his help with. I hadn't liked the direction of Republican efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare, and had already made that clear in public remarks. Unable to find agreement among Senate Republicans for a replacement, the leadership was grasping for a minimalist proposal that could be acceptable at least temporarily to most Republicans. The House had already passed a bill which I couldn't support. Senate leadership would eventually settle on an approach that could be best described as repeal and good luck to you. No serious attempt had been made to see if Democrats would cooperate with us to address some of Obamacare's problems while we continued trying to find consensus among ourselves on a comprehensive alternative. Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray, the chair and ranking minority member of the Senate Health Committee, had been working on just such an approach. But the Republican leadership, primarily Mitch McConnell and his staff, were making most, if not all, of the decisions. They are experienced, skillful political tacticians. Health care is an issue that divides Republicans in both houses of Congress, not so much in our opposition to Obamacare, but over how to reduce the numbers of uninsured people. Not long ago, John Boehner, enjoying the freedom of expression that comes with retirement, observed that Republicans would never agree on a replacement for Obamacare. He was speaking a truth learned over many attempts at trying to reach such a consensus. It was never there, and it still isn't. Republicans had just a 2-vote margin in the Senate, 3 if you count the vice president's tiebreaker vote, so they could only afford to lose 2 Republicans. Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski appeared to be likely no votes. Republican leaders looked for an alternative to Obamacare that would have the best chance of attracting the rest of us. They came up with something they called skinny repeal, which repealed key provisions of Obamacare and offered nothing as a replacement. Mitch and I have been on different sides of a few issues over the years, especially in campaign finance reform debates, where we were each other's principal antagonists. But contrary to Washington myth, we get along pretty well. We like and respect each other. We've known each other a long time. Both of us are in our fourth decade of Senate service. I admire his discipline, political IQ, and maturity. I also appreciate that he allows me an informal leadership role on national security.